the other with the other parts, because I did read it.
All right.
I thought you were talking about a more recent analysis.
Oh, no.
What should we do? Should we have, should we go out to a bar or make some cookies like that, or
yeah.
What?
Yeah, you're onto something with that one. Yeah.
I've never had anybody in any of my classes today. Surprisingly.
Yeah, it was a miserable day. People got up and saw the rain and decided to stay home.
I almost didn't show up because my first class got canceled because of Passover.
Oh, that's right. That's
a I didn't show up because I don't want to go to school because my baby canceled.
Damn it, if I thought of that.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of Jewish people in this class.
My wife is Jewish, but unfortunately she's not observant. Otherwise I would have gotten another day off. Okay. All right, listen, while we're waiting for people to show up, let me do a kind of a brief review of what we have been talking about, last week, because I know that there's some faces here who were not here last time. So we're trying to get to the point where we can discuss intelligently Kant's perpetual thesis. Remember, perpetual thesis is kind of a new document. It's one of the few philosophical works that has actually had an impact on history. Back to China. it's one of the few works that's actually had an impact on history, and the evidence is that Kant wrote Perpetual Peace in the latter part of the 18th century, but it was then read by a German legal scholar by the name of Hans Kelsen. And Kelsen was the most important scholar of international law of his day. And he had written several treatises on international law inspired by Kant's document. When the First World War happened, and in the aftermath of the First World War, Woodrow Wilson, among other world leaders, had been influenced by Kelsen. And they decided to try to implement Kelsen's version of Kant's proposal in Perpetual Peace. And that implementation took the form of the League of Nations. And you'll see that there's actually a phrase which in German, translated into English, means literally League of Nations in Kant's writings. And so the name was taken from Kant's document. And the structure, at least there was an attempt to come close to the structure that Kant had advocated. But of course, the League of Nations failed miserably. It failed for a couple of reasons. One reason was that although Wilson wanted the U.S. to become a member of the League, the U.S. Senate prohibited it. They blocked U.S. entry into the League of Nations. But another reason is that the League of Nations was tied to the Treaty of Versailles, which imposed very severe conditions on the Germans after their defeat in World War I. And, for example, reparations were levied against the Germans. And reparations here, the Germans tended to call reparations tribute. And it was hard to figure out a way to excuse it as anything but tribute. It was the tribute that a victor exacts from the vanquished. And the Germans were also prohibited from developing a serious military force and so on. So the aftermath of the Treaty of Versailles left a great deal of resentment and humiliation in German society. And that resentment and humiliation was part of the reason why Hitler was able to come to power. And certainly the far right, and in particular the Nazi Party, in the aftermath of World War I, made political hay out of the treatment that the Germans had received as a result of the Treaty of Versailles. Well, it was difficult, and we'll see in particular why that was the case. It was difficult, and to say the least, and actually hypocritical, to try to implement a policy of Kantian world peace while one of the primary players on the international scene was being subject to punitive reparations. Like I said, we'll see how this comes out in the details of Kant's document. But in spite of its, or in addition to its practical implications and its political success, least insofar it was embodied, not just in one institution, but in two, because, of course, following the Second World War, another attempt was made to implement Kant's proposal, and that attempt has survived down to the present, and, of course, that's the United Nations. And one of the interesting things to do with perpetual peace is to take a look and see to what extent the UN deviates from Kant's original proposal. If it does it deviate in a positive direction or a negative direction? And of course, there's the large scale question to ask, if Kant's proposal was meant to put an end to international war, how come the UN hasn't done that? And so we'll take a look at that as well. But before we do all that, remember that for Kant, his writing on perpetual peace is a part of his moral philosophy, and it flows directly from the central principle of his moral philosophy, which, remember, according to Kant, is called the categorical imperative. You have to be sensitive to the way that moral thinking changes when we make the transition between the medieval and the ancient worlds on the one hand and the modern world on the other. In the ancient world, moral philosophy presupposed the existence, prior to the rise of the empires anyway, of integrated, small-scale, self-directed human communities. And so the central question of ethics for the ancients was the question, how is it possible to be happy given the nature of human social and communal life? The reference was always to the community and to the person as a member of the community. This was also true in the Middle Ages, although in the Middle Ages the community that the person was a member of became supernatural in character. So certainly there were political organizations that characterized human life on the earth, you know, in this life, but the church is the primary moral authority during the Middle Ages preached that people's true home was in the kingdom of heaven. And so St. Augustine wrote a very important treatise called The City of God, in which he draws a distinction between what he calls the human city and the divine city. It's only in the divine city that genuinely moral relations between people are possible. That isn't to say that people don't have moral obligations in their lives while they're on the earth, right, prior to their death. But whatever moral obligations they have are relative and secondary to the major moral obligation that they have to God and to the kingdom that is coming. And not only is that the case, but it's also the case that human social existence is imperfect, because according to Augustine, we are all heirs of original sin. You know, as the sons and daughters of Adam, we inherit original sin. And the only thing that's capable of saving us from that is God's grace. Well, any political community that we build, by virtue of the fact that we are heirs of original sin, is by its very nature going to be imperfect. So in Christianity, what you get is this notion that the community that makes morality significant is a community that lies, on the one hand, in the future, you know, after our deaths, after the second coming of Christ on a large scale, right, after the apocalypse. And on the other hand, it lies in a transcendent dimension above us. It's in the heavenly sphere rather than the earthly sphere. Walker. Well, that doesn't change the fact, however, that in both cases, the point of reference is not the isolated individual, it's the person as a member of a community. You know, that's where the virtues are acquired and where they're exercised, whether they are the ancient virtues of courage and wisdom and justice and so forth, or the specifically Christian virtue of charity, virtues of charity and love. You know, they're expressed within the context of a community. What happens in the modern period is that reference to the community dissolves. Or at the very best, it takes second place. And now the primary figure in moral philosophy is not the community. It's not the polis, as it was for the ancient Greeks. It's not the city of God, as it was for the medieval Christians. It is now the individual. And this is not an accident. You know, it's not the case that all of a sudden people decide to abandon a long tradition and adopt a new approach because somebody got a bright idea. What's actually happening is that the individual, for the first time in the modern sense of the word, has emerged. Now, when you think about it, what the beginnings of the modern period are tied up with a process of uprooting. So even if you go back to the 1500s, even if you go back to the great voyages of discovery, if you read Thomas More's book, Utopia, and More was the Christian saint and martyr, if you read his book, Utopia, there's a passage in the book where More says that in England, the sheep are eating people. In England, the sheep are eating people. Of course, sheep are not carnivorous animals. They don't literally eat people. But what Moore is referring to in Utopia is the process through which farmers are being thrown off the land in England as the English common lands are enclosed and privatized for the purpose of sheep herding. Now, the Boston Common is actually a leftover of an old English institution. If you go to England now, I think I might have mentioned this at one point. If you go to England now, if you go to the countryside, you notice immediately that it differs from the American countryside. In the American countryside, in farming areas, you can't walk through people's farms. You know, the farms are enclosed, they're private. And if there are farms that are continuous with one another, they share a boundary, you can't get in between the farms, you know, to move along that boundary. But in England, you can walk through the entire countryside. There are common pathways that are a part of, you know, the common rights of the English between farms. So there's no place in England that you cannot walk with the exception of the actual private property of the farmers themselves. And I did this once. It's very interesting. It's a whole different conception of what the countryside is. I don't know if people are... Has anybody been to Great Meadows in Concord? Great Meadows is a wildlife refuge, and it's really quite a beautiful wildlife refuge that is owned by the, it's the National Park Service. But there was a pretty large area of land abutting the Great Meadows Wildlife Refuge, and with a this goes back 20 years. I remember talking to a student in one of my classes who was a resident of Concord, and she filled me in on what was going on. My wife and I would go out there and take walks, and we would go through this long dike trail, but end up in the part of the land that abutted the wildlife reserve. And there was a sign that said, private property. But we noticed right away that people were ignoring the sign and just walking right past it and into a second forested area with a couple of bodies of water. And then on the edges of the bodies of water, there were big, expensive homes. Wherever you went within this second abutting piece of property, you came up against signs, right? Private property, keep out. Then after you moved, like, I don't know, 300 yards into the private property, you'd come up with another sign, you know, as though they knew that they had to warn people repeatedly not to come in. Well, I talked to my student about this, and she said that land in Concord was contested. That the homeowners along the ponds were claiming the land as their private property, but the people of Concord, and in particular the people who came to the wildlife refuge, were claiming it as common land, as land that ought to be accessible to free passage. As I remember going there once, my parents were visiting me from New Jersey at the time, and I took them, my wife and I took them into this piece of land that was in dispute, and a car drove up, and some of the families had hired guards to try to get people out of these areas. And the guy said to me, you know, this is private property, you can't stay here. And I immediately said to him, you know as well as I do that this is contested, and I'm not moving. And he just drove off. Well, the story was that if the owners had been able to force people to refrain from walking through that land, then as a matter of law, it would have de facto become private property. What kept it open was the refusal of other people to obey those signs. And I have to report, I'm happy to report, that now there are no more signs. The campaign on the part of people who went to the wildlife refuge was successful, and that whole area is now common, with the exception of the actual homes of the people who live on the lake, right? Yeah.
But did the people held titles or property of the area?
It was in dispute. And the reason why it was in dispute is that we in New England have the British tradition of the commons, you see. Okay, and I started to say Boston Common is simply a leftover from that British tradition. It's a part of the land of the city of Boston that cannot be brought into private ownership. Of course, many cities have urban parks, but New York Central Park is not called New York Common. It's the word common connects us to that British tradition. Well, there was a great deal of common land around 1500. And the common land was important to the people who farmed, especially the small farmers in England, because they could collect wood or animal dung for heating purposes from the common lands. They could do a little bit of gardening on the common lands and so forth. But an international market in wool developed. And it developed around the same time as the Great Voyages of Discovery. Actually, Utopia, the book Utopia, is written with those voyages in the background. The island of Utopia is an island that one of the navigators happens upon in his voyage of discovery. And so Thomas More, in the novel, says that the people are, the sheep are eating the people. What he meant by that was that the lords in the British countryside, were throwing fences up around the common. And these fences were being protected by the local sheriffs. And so when poor farmers tried to use their traditional rights to the common, they were prevented from doing so by the sheriffs, and some of them were beaten up, some of them were thrown in jail, and so forth. And in that fashion, the vast majority of the common land in England was privatized. The reason why this is significant is you have to remember that England 200 years later was the first country to launch the Industrial Revolution. And the Industrial Revolution involved the construction of machine-driven factories in the great cities of England, you know, Manchester and Birmingham and Leeds and London to some extent. Well, the factories would not have functioned if there had not been people available to work in them. And the people who were available to work in the factories were the people who had been uprooted from the English countryside, were no longer able to make a living because of the privatization of the common lands, and so migrated to the British cities, where they formed a large semi-employed population desperate for work. Same thing is happening in China now, by the way. Although in China, it's more difficult for people to leave the land. Because by leaving the land, you also leave certain benefits that are attached to the land. There's still a massive migration of of Chinese people from the countryside into the cities as China undergoes its own industrial revolution at breakneck pace. Well, what happens when people are uprooted from the countryside and move to the cities, of course, is they lose their communal bonds. Now, in the United States, this is a very clear and well-established process because the U.S., after all, has always been a nation of immigrants. So what we've seen in the United States is that each group of immigrants is essentially, until very recently anyway, a rural population that has been connected to traditional moral standards, traditional ways of interacting socially, traditional religious institutions, linguistic, and even culinary traditions back home. And so they uproot themselves from their places of origin and come to the U.S. in search of work, in search of money, in search of whatever it is that they're in search of. But in the process, they've lost their roots. There's a transitional phenomenon there, right? And that is, in U.S. history, it's been common for the first generation of immigrants to set up ethnic neighborhoods in the major American cities. And in the ethnic neighborhoods, the old ways are preserved as best they can be. So, you know, the Irish neighborhoods in Southie, the Italian neighborhoods in North Jersey, which is where I was born and lived the first 5 years of my life, and went back, you know, to visit my grandparents every Sunday and had dinner, an Italian dinner with the extended family and so forth. The Russian communities, you name it, Lithuanian, Chinese, Japanese. The process of immigration always involves the initial establishment of a kind of compromise between the old world, which has been left behind, and the anonymity of life in urban America. Generally, these neighborhoods last for a generation, two generations. They may last longer than that as new waves of immigrants come in. I mean, look at Chinatown, right? Although that's beginning to change now as Chinatown is gentrified. But what invariably happens is that by the second and third generations, those people leave the ethnic neighborhoods, they move, they become footloose and fancy free, they become real Americans, namely people without roots. You know, we are the rootless society par excellence. Let's face it, the only thing that Americans share nationally is a mass media culture. You know, we certainly don't share a common ethnic background or a common store of myths or a common religion. And so, but my basic point is this. As this process gets played out, begins in 1500 and it's still being played out in places like China today, as this process gets played out, the result is, for the first time, the emergence of the individual. Now, the real social forces behind this are the uprooting of people from their traditional communities and their participation in the market-driven urban life of modern society. By the time Kant came along, the Industrial Revolution was in its early stages, and there had already been 250 years of this going on from 1500 to Kant's day. So for Kant, as for other philosophers, the communal standpoint of the ancient world and of the medieval world was no longer available. It certainly didn't make sense to talk about the Greek polis anymore, for the Greek polis hadn't existed for 1700 years. No, actually 2,000 years. It didn't make sense to talk about the city of God anymore. People were still Christians by and large, but they practiced their Christianity as a private affair. In other words, Christian culture was not the primary determinant, and certainly the Catholic Church was not the primary determinant of people's social lives. It began to enter more and more into the realm of individual belief. And so now the question is, how do you do morality? How do you do philosophical ethics from the standpoint of the individual? The whole tradition of ancient and medieval ethics gets jettisoned. And now philosophers have to find the basis of morality within the isolated individual person. Well, many, you know, different philosophers found it in different ways. You know, the utilitarians found it in people's individual desires for pleasure and happiness. And they said that utilitarian position is that action or policy is best, which maximizes the pleasure of everybody concerned. But pleasure here is no longer even pleasure in the Epicurean sense. It's not the pleasure of someone who takes up his or her role within an Epicurean community. It's the pleasure of the individual human being. Kant finds the basic principle of morality somewhere else, not in pleasure, which he thinks is a bad way to go about moral philosophy. He finds it in what he calls the categorical imperative. You know, and remember, I'll put it down on the board again. The categorical imperative has two formulations. The first one, since we've got people who weren't here last time, the first one is act always in such a way. Act always in such a way. That you can will that the maximum of your action holds as a universal law. Notice, there's no mention of the virtues in that. There's no mention of courage, there's no mention of justice, there's no mention of wisdom or of moderation. There's no mention of anything that's concrete at all. And Kant says that this is exactly what's necessary for the basic principle of morality. The basic principle of morality is a filtering principle to begin with. You know, the way Kant sets it up is, he says, look, there are many candidates for moral principle. Many different cultures have come up with different conceptions of what a moral principle is. Bear with me, the people who were here last time. Thou shalt not kill is a candidate for a moral principle. You know, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife is a candidate for a moral principle. Thou shalt annihilate the racially inferior is a candidate for a moral principle. Certainly, the Nazis held that it was moral to do so in Germany during the period of the Third Reich. Thou shalt leave thy male son in the forest to fend for himself against the wild creatures, and if he perishes, so be it. You know, that's a moral principle that Spartan society offered. Kant's problem is this. In a way, it's the problem of ancient moral philosophy, too. Given these conflicting candidates for moral principle, how do we know which ones are really moral and which ones are not? What we need is a filtering principle. We need a principle that can select from all, among all of the various candidates. That principle cannot itself have any content, because if it had content, it would be a specific candidate rather than the filtering principle. Now, for example, let's say that we took as our supreme moral principle, thou shalt not kill. Well, that's no good. How is thou shalt not kill going to help us to sift between all of the other candidates? Any filtering principle has got to be, as Kant says, completely formal in character. It has to have no content to it. The form is what's significant. And what the form is of this is what Kant calls universalizability. Universalizability. Moral principles, according to Kant, must be universalizable. Right? They must be universalizable. And what that means is we can test any candidate for a moral principle by asking, does it accord with this? Act always in such a way that you can will. Say, I should put it here, that you can will that the maximum of your action holds as a universal law. The maximum of an action here is simply the candidate principle. You know, if you go around, you're married. Let's use a racier example than the ones that I gave last week. You're married, and you decide to have an affair with your next door neighbor's spouse. You want to stay married. You're not interested in leaving your spouse. You're just interested in having an affair with your next door neighbor's spouse. What is the universal version of that? The maximum of your action here is that when I feel like it, it's okay for me to have an affair with my neighbor's spouse. But what's the universal form of that?
That's what I found with my oldest spouse.
If you have the energy. It's not that you can have an affair with all the spouses.
Your spouse can have anybody can have
it. It's that anybody, that whenever someone experiences the sexual urge, no matter what their marital status is, it is okay for them to cheat. But of course, once we universalize the principle, what we see is that marriage becomes irrelevant and unsustainable. What is a marriage in which there are no limitations on the sexual behavior of the partners? Now, fidelity seems to be built into what the very notion of marriage is. Kant says that when I have sex with my next-door neighbor's wife, what I mean to demand is not that everyone be capable of doing that when they want to, but that everyone maintain the sanctity of marriage except me. Because after all, if I universalize it, then my own marriage is threatened. What I want is to be able to enjoy the security of marriage and still have a lot of fun when I desire it. But what that means here, we can see by applying the categorical imperative that what's happening is what I really want is for the universal rule, be faithful to one's spouse, to apply. Except for me. Except in my case.
Let's say that I hold truth that if a group of people is being oppressed by other, they have the right to kill their oppressor.
Mm-hmm.
Kant will ask me, what if you are the oppressor? You know, would you, like, do you think you'll have the right to get killed? That they have the right to kill you if we universalize this. The normal answer will be like, no, I don't want to get killed. But what if I say, yes, if I am oppressing another group of people, I do believe that they have the right.
But that's what Kant believes as well. You see, because for Kant, what's happening in the case of the person who oppresses another is what you're getting is a denial of the rights and the personhood of the oppressed by the oppressor. Kant recognizes that there is a traditional right of resistance against oppression. Look, it's up the see. How, can we can think of the following? There are two scenarios, right? Which one can be universalized? Whenever anybody wants to oppress anybody else, it's okay for them to do so, or it's not okay for anybody to oppress anybody else. See, clearly, the only one that can be universalized is the second. If you say that it's okay for anybody to oppress anybody, then the oppressor is the victim, becomes the victim, the potential victim of oppression. And what the oppressor wants is not to be oppressed. What the oppressor wants is to oppress without himself or herself being oppressed. Therefore, the oppressor cannot universalize the principle of oppression. Whenever you're stronger than somebody else, oppress them. Because there's some guy out there who's stronger than you. And that gives that person a warrant to oppress you. And that's not what you had in mind. But you can universalize the principle, no one should oppress anyone. Because where does that come apart? If no one oppresses anyone, then everyone is free to enjoy their freedom. You see? So what we have here is two possibilities. You see, it's not the oppressed who resists even to the point of killing that violates the categorical imperative. It's the oppressor that violates the categorical imperative.
If I'm cheating my wife, just to go back to the other one, if I'm cheating on my wife and the universal solution would be that, okay, date somebody else, one of your own neighbors can sleep with your wife, what if you say, okay.
But
does that make it moral, according to
you? Well, let me put it this way. In principle, I guess there's nothing that's unsustainable about a society in which there's no marriage. Hmm. Although it would be hard to imagine, really. I mean, I can't imagine. Actually, as far as I know, there's never been a society that has been without some kind of institution of marriage. It differs from society to society. In Morocco, it's still okay for men to have multiple wives if they can afford multiple wives. You know, in our society, monogamy is the legal and the ethical rule. But But I can't think of a single society that doesn't have some marriage institution. And why is that, by the way? Is that just because people want to be secure in their sexual relations? Why is it that there's an institution of marriage? I'm just asking a sociological question, not really a moral one. What would happen if there were no institution of marriage? Or
males will not take care of their offspring.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, clearly marriage is related to some kind of stable family structure, the need for some kind of stable family structure, and the stability of family structure is necessary for child rearing, right? So without marriage, you have people having loads of fun, but no stable way of socializing kids. Unless you develop some kind of a collective, I guess you could imagine a collective institution in which children were brought up the way they are in Orwell's dystopia.
Well, it's kind of like going back to the Spartans. When they had a child in Spartan, Spartan community, it wasn't their own, it was the community.
The community
rose it until they let them out into the wild.
Yeah, and I suppose you could imagine that in the Israeli kibbutz in its glory days. There was a kind of similar principle. Children did not live with their parents. Now, the kibbutzim is plural for kibbutz, was an agricultural commune that was set up by people mainly from the labor movement in early Israel. And the idea was that people would farm the land in common without private ownership. There would be a rotation of job functions. And by the way, this also crossed gender boundaries. So men as well as women would work in the creches, for example, in the nurseries. And children would not live with their parents, although they had a bond with their parents, a special bond with their parents. They would live as a group with other children and be taken care of by whomever was responsible for doing that on that during that particular week. There was a book written by Bruno Bettelheim, who is a psychoanalyst, called Children of the Dream. And there was controversy about the children of the kibbutz. You know, were they well-adjusted? Were they creative? Did they lack anything that kids who grew up in conventional families lacked? And Bettelheim claimed that they were extraordinarily well-adjusted, but not particularly creative, in the kids of the kibbutz. And then Bettelheim's research was taken to task by critics. And as far as I remember, you know, the consensus finally was that there isn't much of a difference between kids raised on the kibbutz and kids raised in traditional two-parent families. But maybe the reason why is that the kibbutz did not cut children off from their parents. You know, parents still had a special relationship with their kids, even though their kids did not live in the same living unit as the parents. So it wasn't quite collective upbringing. It was kind of a compromise between collective upbringing and upbringing by the parents whose child is involved. The only point, though, is that marriage structures seem to be integrally related to the need for stable families and the need for stable methods of child rearing. So could you universalize whenever anybody wants to have sex with a partner, as long as the partner agrees it's fine for them to do so for their whole life? I guess, sure. What you can't universalize is that whenever anybody wants to violate the marriage vow, it's okay for them to do so. In other words, because that destroys marriage as an institution. See, it's conceivable, I suppose it's conceivable, that under some social arrangements there would be no such thing as marriage. Let's say that the population became self-sustaining. You know, there's an advance in biomedicine, and we're now all going to be immortal. You know, you're not going to have to die. Well, clearly, if that's the case, having kids becomes problematic. Right, because that just adds. I mean, what enables children to be born, what makes it possible, is the fact that we're all going to die. Right, we make room on the surface of the earth for the next generation. But if we're no longer going to make room for the next generation, then clearly we're going to have to do something about birth rates. And if immortality really became possible as a result of genetic advances, the only thing it seems to me that we could do is eliminate birth. But then you wouldn't need stable family structures in order to raise kids. And so, you know what I'm saying? We've gotten into science fiction here, clearly. I hope, anyway. I would rather see at least a good number of the people that I know die than achieve immortality. But in any event, but you get the point? Yeah. You want to test whether something is moral, try to universalize it. If you can't, reject it. If you can, accept it. That's how you determine what a candidate principle for which candidate principles for morality are genuinely moral. Now, this is a very formal, abstract thing, but Kant immediately says there's a second formulation here, which we also discussed last week. Let me put it on the board. Act always in such a way that you can, that you treat humanity, whether in your own person or that of another, always as an end and never as a means merely. Sean, what does it mean to treat somebody as a means merely?
As a means merely?
Yeah.
We talked about this last week.
Yes.
Hold on a second.
That's why I assume you know it. Well, first of all, what does it mean to treat somebody as a means?
It's like using someone.
Yeah, you're using someone.
Yeah.
What does it mean to treat them as a means merely?
You're using them and then they have feelings or that they know that they're aware of you using them.
Well, the merely part of it simply means that's the only way you're treating them.
Right.
Right? Kant makes a distinction between things that it is appropriate to treat as means and persons which it is inappropriate to treat as means. Tools are means to achieving our ends. You know, a hammer is a means to constructing a home. You can take the hammer and fling it into the woods if you want to, and you will have harmed no one. Because because the hammer is not a person. The hammer is a thing. The hammer is not an end. The hammer is a means to an external end. But what is it now? Give me an example of treating somebody as a means.
Like telling someone to do something. So, like use slavery.
Yeah.
Or employees.
Slaves or employees.
Yeah, right. Slaves
or
employees.
Or
students.
Students, right. Yeah, I'm using you all as a means to get paid. You know, and unless you show up, there's no class, and if there's no class, I don't get paid. So am I violating the categorical imperative?
Absolutely.
What would Kant say? Kant was a professor. Was he violating the categorical imperative when he taught classes? No. Why not?
He was not treating people just merely as
means. Merely as a means, right? Yeah, of course. He was treating students as a means just as I'm treating you as a means. But he wasn't treating them as a means merely, right? He had, for example, in his teaching, a concern about educating the young, about, you know, introducing them to his own brand of moral philosophy. In other words, and in any event, you know, he was perfectly civil and kind to students whenever that kind of behavior was called for. What that means is, in social life, we all treat each other as means. You know, we have to. You know, if I buy something from you, I treat you as a means to getting what it is that I want. What Kant is prohibiting through the categorical imperative is not treating you as a means, but treating you as a means merely, as nothing but an instrument to achieve my end. Slavery is a good example because in the Politics, Aristotle says, gives his definition of the slave. He says the slave is a living tool. Well, the slave is someone whose personhood does not have to be recognized by the slave master. You know, the slave is someone who is used as an instrument merely by the slave master, which is, by the way, Kant's argument against slavery. What is it that distinguishes between things that should be treated as persons and things that can be treated as means merely? How do we distinguish the two? Kant says, treat humanity here, but he does not mean humanity as a biological species. So I happen to be human. You know, that should be no more morally relevant than my happening to be white or my happening to be a man. Now, you wouldn't accept the judgment that I ought to treat only men well as a moral judgment. You wouldn't accept the judgment that I should treat only white people well as a moral judgment, as a morally correct position. Why should you accept the judgment that it's only okay to treat humans well? Now, humanity, biological humanity, is no different than skin color or than gender. It's a contingent characteristic. What is it that Kant means? What is it that Kant means when he talks about humanity? What is he getting at? What is it that makes people deserving of respect?
Because you want respect. If you want respect, it means other people want respect.
Certainly, beings who are capable of giving respect are the sorts of beings who can also
expect
respect. But why is that? What kinds of beings are capable of giving respect? What is it that distinguishes members of the moral community from beings that are outside of the moral community? What beings are outside of the moral community? We know the tools are, right? You don't have to worry about tools, but what else?
Is there reason?
Yeah. It is the possession of reason that distinguishes between persons and things. See, I mean, reason here means the capacity to conduct your life in accordance with your own lights. If you are a machine, you know, if you're a robot who just does nothing but what you have been programmed to do, then for Kant, you are not a candidate for membership in the moral community. To be a candidate for membership in the moral community means that you must be a freely acting being who is capable of shaping their lives through the application of reason. And by the way, for Kant, to be free and to be capable of rationality are the same thing. I mean, think about it, right? If you have no choice, if all decisions are made for you, and if you never resist that, if you simply live your life by following the orders of someone else, then you are neither free nor are you exercising your independent rational capacities. You're obviously not free because your actions are determined by somebody outside of yourself. But, and then you are in no position to exercise rationality because you're in no position to initiate a course of action at all. You know, you don't act because it seems reasonable for you to act the way you do. You act because you are being controlled by someone else. So that for Kant, to be free and to be rational and to be capable of rationality are the same thing. There's only beings who are free and capable of rationality that are more than just means. Now, for Kant, you know, the proper moral attitude toward beings who are free and capable of rationality, he calls the attitude of respect. And respect here doesn't mean respect for the particular accomplishments of somebody. It doesn't mean respect for somebody because they're older or because they're more powerful. It means respect for someone simply because they are capable of rationality and freely self-active. To
say that they're capable of rationality and freedom of self-acting means that they have interests of their own. They are like me. And when I think about my life, what am I doing? You think about your own life for a second. Now, what is it that makes you distinctive? What is it that makes you a person at all? In part, it's the fact that you have some overall conception of your life. You make choices, and you make choices that are uniquely yours. You give a shape to the ongoing process of living. And it's that process of making choices, it's that shaping of your ongoing experience into something that is particularly your own that Kant says demands respect. Yeah.
Could I advocate for human traits in animals or reason in animals?
Sure, you could. Yeah. Kant would not agree with you, but that doesn't mean that Kant's right and you're wrong, right? If you find that, take an example here. Take the large-brained animals. Take dolphins, which are always an interesting case. Elephants. Take dolphins and elephants. Right? These are both big-brained animals. Let's say it turns out that dolphins are making choices. You know, let's say that it turns out that dolphins have some version of rationality. What would follow for Kant?
What would follow?
Yeah.
We will have to treat them as, as
persons. Yeah. You see, the category of person is not identical with the category of human. If people, you know, came down from Alpha Centauri tomorrow, if they showed up in a spaceship on the White House lawn, and if we could have a conversation with them, and if we could ask them where they came from and why they decided to do so, you know, to visit us, and through some process of translation we got an answer that we understood, or if we at least had the suspicion that they have a conception of why they've done what they've done, then they are freely self-acting beings and therefore must be treated as persons. See, personhood, in other words, membership in the moral community, does not either require nor is it limited to biological humanity. It just so happens that most of the beings that we are familiar with right now who are rational tend to be human. But if dolphins, you know, make choices, and if dolphins are capable of reason of some kind, then dolphins are persons too.
Do we?
What do you think about dolphins, Carlos? Are there any big dolphin fans here? Dolphins and whales, the cetaceans? They have bigger brains than we do in proportion to body weight. Right? They have bigger brains than we do in proportion to their body weight. They're capable of complex acts of communication. And acts of communication that I don't think we can even imagine. Whether they have a language or not is controversial, but one of the capacities that dolphins possess, which I would love to possess, is of course they have their primary navigating device is not vision, it's sonar. So they let out a series of high-pitched clicks, and then they receive echoes from those clicks as they bounce off of objects in the ocean. Well, the clicks and the echoes penetrate the three-dimensional objects that they are getting their bearings from, including the bodies of other dolphins. So researchers into dolphin behavior suggest that when dolphins use echolocation and there are other dolphins in the path of the echo, what they get is a kind of three-dimensional X-ray image of the body of the other dolphin. But they get it, of course, in real time with all of its moving processes. You know, it's like having an MRI of someone constantly before you. I look at all of you and what I see is which portions of your body are consuming oxygen right now. You know, that tells me who's barely awake. You know, who's trying desperately to look like they're listening but are, is thinking about dinner. That tells me if I'm a dolphin, who is sexually interested and who is not. It tells me who is angry and who isn't. Now, there's no ability. You might be able to hide anger in the form of facial expression, but you can't hide anger in the form of an accelerated pulse rate or an accelerated rate of breathing, all of which would be visible to a dolphin who has a moving three-dimensional image of another organic creature. Well, that is about as close to telepathy as you're ever going to get. Obviously, it's not telepathy because it's an ordinary physical process, but it gives, presumably, you know, if the researchers are right, dolphins an immediate insight into the inner lives of actually any other organism that comes their way. Yeah.
And also, dolphins are the only animal besides humans that have sex just for fun and for reproductive.
And you've spoken with them about this?
I've seen them. I'm a big fan of dolphins.
Yeah,
I hesitate. I'm not sure about dolphins, but I'll tell you. I would hesitate to put one in a sandwich and gobble it down.
Did you ever see orcas hunting, orca whales hunting?
I've seen dumps of it, yeah.
They hunt just for fun. Like, they go and kill their prey, and they don't even...
Ah, so they are like humans.
Yeah. No, exactly. They take seals, and they fling them across the water, like...
Yeah, they actually have fun with their prey.
Yeah.
They do it for fun.
Or they'll chase, like, baby, like, whales, and they'll just chase them until the prey runs out of breath, and then they attack it, and they just... They don't really eat it. They just kind of let it die.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite possible that you're dealing with the cetaceans, with the dolphins and whales, that you're dealing with a kind of intelligence, a kind of intelligent life that's just radically different than the intelligent life of humanity. Mm-hmm. Dolphins have no opposable thumbs, right?
Yeah.
So there's no dolphin or whale technology. They haven't built any cities.
Yeah.
Right? But, on the other hand, their personal lives, their interpersonal lives, seem to be a lot richer.
Yeah.
By virtue of echolocation, what I was just talking about. It's, the jury might be out on that, and the jury might be out on elephants too, you know, which exhibit, some people have claimed, moral behavior, which elephants return to visit the graves of their young or the graves of their parents, and can actually pick out the graves of their young and the graves of their parents. It seems that there's a kind of pardon me.
Saying the elephant never forgets.
Yeah, right. Elephants never forget. Well, anyway, I guess that's what it means, because that's what it refers to. Kant, by the way, doesn't say it's okay to treat animals cruelly. But why not? You know, if animals don't possess reason and therefore are not persons, then why shouldn't we treat animals cruelly? What difference does it make? They don't have the status of moral beings. It's the problem with cruelty to animals.
You can't make it universal. You can't universalize it.
But you don't have to, because they're not members of the moral community.
Well, that's in a different... That's in its first statement. Its first statement doesn't necessarily say that it has to be against humanity.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're right, but...
So it breaks one of the two laws.
Well, for Kant, what Kant claims is that these laws are formulations for the same principle.
Okay.
That the second doesn't add anything to the first. It just spells out the meaning of the first in a different way. For him, universalizability... Well, first of all, universalizability applies to action. And only beings that are free act, which means only persons act. Which means that if animals are not persons, they don't act. So even the first formulation doesn't apply to them. But why is animal... Why is it when you see somebody torturing an animal, if you don't believe that animals are full members of the moral community, why is it that you recoil?
Because maybe
you kind of take in torture as universal. Anything doesn't have to be to another moral.
Well, let's say you have a kid, right? And you notice that your kid is spending an awful lot of time pulling the wings off of flies, and burning. Cats with a magnifying glass.
Because one day he made those things too human.
Yeah, of course. The problem with cruelty to animals is that it lowers the level of resistance to cruelty to people. Now, people who are cruel to animals are likely to be the same kinds of people who are cruel to human beings. And so the prohibition against cruelty to animals has a moral warrant behind it, but ultimately because it affects the interests of rational beings, namely the interests of human beings. This is Kant's view anyway. Well, okay. So we've got these two principles, and now we have another thing. Right? Both of them are rooted within our individual persons. The categorical imperative is inside you. How do we know? Because when you violate it, you hear the voice of conscience. Now, you steal something because you want it. You can't universalize that, because if you universalized it, everybody would be able to steal what they wanted. You would not be secure in your own possessions. You are making an exception for yourself. You feel a pang of conscience, if you do feel a pang of conscience, because the categorical imperative is speaking within you. The categorical imperative is a part of the internal makeup of the individual rational being, according to Kant. And if it were not, the phenomenon of conscience would be unintelligible, according to him.
So somebody who does not experience the feelings of guilt or the effects of conscience for the things they've done, you can't reason that they are not necessarily a part of humanity?
That's a good question. What you're talking about here is someone who just has no conscience at all. Not someone who buries it down deep. Not someone who hides it, you know, or even hides it from him or herself, but someone who just completely lacks it. Now, there's a word for this in psychopathology. What is it? Pardon me?
Is that a sociopath?
Yeah, that's a sociopath, right? That's a sociopath. Sociopathy, if you could determine that that someone was a genuine sociopath, and you could also determine that there was no possibility of them getting out of it, although that would be a hard determination to make, then I suppose you could say that they are not members of the moral community. But there are also consequences for doing that. Because let's say we start to designate certain parts of the human community as non-persons. Let's say that severely mentally retarded people. Right? Severely mentally retarded people do not possess rationality, nor are they able to make choices. And so we say, all right, it's okay to eliminate them. What's the problem with that?
It's a slippery slope.
Yeah, it's a slippery slope. And it also goes back to the problem of cruelty to animals. You know, in an even more direct sense now, because there is a species commonality between us and the severely retarded. So, yeah, I think Kant would say, if it's true that a being irremediably and irrevocably lacks reason, then it's also true that they are not persons in the full sense of the word. But that does not imply that it's okay to do whatever you want with them. Yeah. Although it's a tough one here. Yes?
Did Kant receive any criticisms to the fact that his first premise is very close to the Christian concept of do not do to others what you don't want to be done to yourself? So it just seems to be just a reformulation into a more philosophical way.
Except that Kant has given you a reason for thinking that something should not be done to even you. You see, I mean, the Christian principle says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Well, I'm not saying that you're a sadomasochist, right? You like to torture and be tortured by other people, but you're willing to allow them to torture and be tortured by you. Is that what we have in mind here?
A sadist is a masochist that follows the golden rule.
You see, it depends upon what it is that we are demanding equal treatment about, right? You see, and so for Kant, it's not enough to say, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. What you have to specify is in what respect. And what Kant is doing is he's specifying that it's in the respect of being a person who deserves respect from others. In other words, what makes do unto others as you would have them do unto you significant is your status as a free moral being. So he's added something through the analysis. It's not just the Christian principle. And he doesn't even say, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. What he says is, although it's related, he says, treat yourself no differently than you treat other people when making moral decisions. But what he's interested in is not so much that bare principle as the fact that for him, social practices, moral practices are not sustainable if you do anything else. In other words, a moral rule that you make an exception of in your own case is not that your behavior is not genuinely moral, because if you universalized it, the rule would disintegrate. Now, in other words, on the level of ethics, what we have here is something like the equivalent of the principle of non-contradiction in logic. The reason why two statements can't contradict one another, if you tell me that I went to the store yesterday, but I didn't go to the store yesterday, and you're not making any discrimination in meaning, you mean exactly the same thing with both statements, except in one case you're asserting that you went to the store, and in the other case you're asserting you did not go to the store, you are not making any sense. It's impossible for me to get any sense out of a contradiction. In other words, the contradiction destroys the significance of the statement. You know, for Kant, a violation of the moral, of the categorical imperative, destroys the significance of the moral rule. It's the same kind of self-negating thing that a contradiction is in logic. If you can't act consistently by universalizing the principle, then you ain't making sense on the level of morality. That's his claim. Right. That's a philosopher's claim. You know, that's not the golden rule claim. You know, it's much easier to understand. All right. Let's say that he's right about this. We're persons. We should be treated with respect. We're all persons insofar as we're rationally self-governed. And we make our own choices. And we get this simply by listening to the voice of conscience within ourselves. And then, of course, engaging in the kind of philosophical analysis that Kant engages in. But now, the vantage point is the individual. We're living in a modern world in which communal structures have broken down. The only vantage point that's available for deriving the principles of morality is the vantage point of the individual. It's the mid-1700s. Not only is the individual well-established, but war is bloody and frequent. War is bloody and frequent. Remember, this is the period of struggle between France and England for global domination. The French and the British armies are meeting on several battlefields. And the result is widespread bloodshed. And not only that, but weapons are beginning to become more sophisticated and more deadly. And Kant, as someone who's very familiar with the scientific revolution, can see, you know, down the line, a few years down the line, weapons becoming extremely destructive. So now we have the categorical imperative, but we also have the widespread practice of destructive war. What happens when we put the two of them together? Well, war, according to Kant, is the most massive violation of the categorical imperative imaginable. Because what the categorical imperative says is treat other people as ends and never as means merely. It says treat other people as persons demanding respect. But on the battlefield, it's impossible to treat the enemy soldier, so long as he is armed anyway, as a person demanding respect. The enemy soldier is an obstacle to the realization of our ends. And we can use whatever means necessary in order to eliminate that obstacle. In other words, war is a massive violation
of personhood and therefore a massive violation of the categorical imperative. And Kant goes further. And he says in Perpetual Peace, not only does war violate the personhood of the enemy soldier, the war violates the personhood of our own soldiers. And his argument is that what war does is it turns people into killing machines. Well, what he's focusing on here is not so much the killing as the machine part of it. Right? What you're taught in basic training is what? What are you taught in basic training?
On what context? Sorry.
What context?
Yeah.
Well, it's the basic principle that the drill sergeant is trying to drill into your head when you're a young recruit and going through basic training.
Kill or be killed?
Well, what else?
Duty, respect, honor, loyalty.
Yeah, and follow orders. Yeah. Right? Your job as a soldier is to follow orders. But if your job as a soldier is to follow orders, then your job as a soldier is not to be freely self-acting. And clearly, you know, the whole point of getting soldiers to follow orders is to turn them into instruments of the achievement of whatever goal the army has set for itself. So what you have here is the failure to treat the soldiers on your own side as ends rather than as means merely. And so for Kant, you have this massive violation of the categorical imperative. What that means is that on the face of it, as they say in Latin, prima facie, there is an obligation that each of us has to work toward the end of war. Look, if the categorical imperative establishes what is moral and what is not, and if war is the biggest violation that we know of the categorical imperative, then it follows that our moral obligation lies in putting an end to war. Kant says, provided one thing, provided that it is possible to do so. Remember last week we spoke about this? If I say to you, you have an obligation to levitate 6 feet above your desk, clearly you have no such obligation. Why not? Because even if there were a moral obligation to do it, what's the problem? You can't do it, right? You can't. I can't say that you have a violation to levitate 6 feet above your desk if it's impossible for you to do so. I can do it, by the way. You know, I've learned how to levitate, but I know a lot of people haven't caught on yet. My wife had a man who came to us once, and she said, you know, she was studying transcendental meditation, you know this thing? Okay. Well, the people who teach the transcendental meditation seminar, they were giving seminars in levitation. So she came to us and she said, do you think I should take this seminar? It's expensive, it's $2,000. And we said to her, no, you know. But the sense that I got was that what she was worried about was the cost. Well, if I thought that seminar was going to teach me to levitate, I would have hocked everything I owed to pay for it, right? And then I've seen films of the transcendental meditators levitate. Have you ever seen these things? They're cross-legged and they're sitting on mats. And what they do is they lift themselves off the floor with their arms by pushing their arms down real fast, and they convince themselves that they've stayed in the air a fraction of a second longer than the laws of physics should allow. And so they're developing the ability to levitate. Well, if the seminar worked, I might be able to say that you have an obligation to levitate in this case, but I'm afraid that the seminar it doesn't work. But what the seminar does show is that, as P.T. Barnum said, there's a sucker for one every minute. In any event, war, it has to be possible to abolish war for us to have an obligation to abolish war. Why isn't it possible to abolish war?
Because how do you stop someone who's dedicated to going to war to get something to oppress someone else? How else to stop them other than with force?
Yeah, Kant, by the way, recognizes the right to defense. See, I mean, it follows pretty automatically from the categorical imperative. If you're a person, and therefore you are an end in yourself and not just a means, and if someone is aggressing against you, threatening your life,
And generally, the option that you're given as the defensive party in a war is the following. You know, you can surrender and lose your freedom, or you can die trying to preserve it. You know, what Kant says is that your right to exercise violence to preserve your freedom is a legitimate right. I mean, after all, that your freedom is what makes you a member of the moral community. So, yeah, what happens if you lay down your arms but the other guy does not? But why wouldn't everybody lay down their arms? Why do some people want to go to war?
Not everyone lives by the moral code.
Not everybody lives by the moral code.
Interests. Monetary interest, political interest, power desire.
People want power, they want monetary interest, they want the expansion of their power, expansion of their... Okay. And this may be true. And this may be, you know, the dominant factor that's been responsible for the existence of war for 2,000 years, 5,000 years, however long we've had war as an institution. But what Kant's point is the following. What was possible in the past is rapidly becoming impossible now. What was possible in the past will be impossible in the future. And what he's talking about is the following. Because of the limited character of human technological power, war in the past was limited. You could have an engagement. There might be blood spilled as the result of that. You know, thousands of people might die, but the species would continue. What Kant anticipates, and it's amazing that he does in the mid-17th century, what he anticipates is the development of human technological power to the point where the continued practice of war threatens the existence of the species. And this is indicated by the significance of the title of his work. He titles his work Perpetual Peace. He says, if you read the very beginning of it, he says that he got the phrase from an innkeeper's sign. And the innkeeper's sign said perpetual peace, and then it had a painting of a grave. And what Kant does is uses this to delineate an alternative. He says, we're going to get perpetual peace one way or the other. We are either going to put an end to war and have the perpetual peace that is associated with that, or we are going to all end up in a mass grave. We're going to have the perpetual peace of the grave. See, the stakes now are unprecedented. And so the issue is it possible, given such high stakes, for people to abolish the institution of war? If it's possible, we have an obligation to work for it. Let's take a break, okay?
Take us out?
Yeah. Oh yeah, you can come and get actually here. You know what? I'll hand out the papers. Jeff Rodriguez, Greg Herman, yep. Wrangley, Dolphin, Griselda. No, Griselda's another place. Oh, here we go. Great. Ellen Nguyen. No, there you go. Sarah Ashley, she's in another class and she's sick. Jennifer Rodriguez, no. Mutt Lee? No. Galen McGrail? I've got a lot of unclaimed papers. Brooke? Brooke? Nope. Is anybody actually... There you go. Kevin? Kevin here? Nope. Trish? There you go. Sean? There you go, Sean.
Thank you.
Appleton? No, no. Allison? Johnny? Amy and Luke. Yours was the last one because yours was the first hand.
Yeah.
To like 5 in the evening.
ATM and get me arrested.
So you can say no.
Yeah, for the past week and a half, I'm thinking about that.
So you have to pay.
I haven't finished it because I was going to finish it Sunday, but I was in jail today because we don't sit
down. I understand. Do you think you can get it in next week?
Yeah, I can get it in next week. It's just going a little.
I'm sure.
It's a little out of the ordinary.
Yeah, it's a little. My nephew's been involved in domestic dispute stuff like this. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm a little familiar with it.
Okay. Good.
It's definitely not a mess.
Messes with your
process.
Yeah.
We'll do your best.
Thank you.
So I just turned back to next week.
And I'll get it back to you next week.
Next week, so can I email you to get to know my grade?
No.
No?
No. You wait. You can wait a week.
A week is too long.
Because I don't know whether I'll get to it until Sunday. It's quite possible.
Okay.
But I won't be able to do that.
Okay.
I know you're anxious to get your grade, but
you
got to give me a break. I mean,
my grade is lower, I want to choose the path of you.
Well, I'll tell you, I'll tell people when they come back, I'll mention it again, but in my classes I allow people to rewrite their midterms.
Oh, we can rewrite?
You have a rewrite option, and the due date for the rewrite is the final day of class.
Oh, that's good.
Okay, so my suggestion is that you don't do pass fail.
Don't.
I mean, you can if you want to, obviously. I'm not going to prevent you. But
okay.
I think it's foolish to, because you'll get the paper back with
my
comments.
Will you give some comments on our paper?
Yes, oh yes.
Oh, so
you'll get comments on the paper, and you can read the comments, and that'll give you direction for doing a rewrite.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you.
Okay. So now get off my back.
Eastern Ave and Lynn.
Yeah.
That goes at 107. I don't know if you're familiar with the area. He turned onto the street and hit a car, and then he hit a parked car.
You were with him?
No, I was with her that night. I saw her like 10 minutes before she came. He hit a parked car, and she was just thrown from the car. She wasn't wearing her seatbelt.
So it was the boyfriend?
Yeah, he's in jail. Well, he got out of jail. He's in a mental hospital.
Oh, God.
But I've just been busy getting the stuff together for the week tomorrow.
That's awesome. Like, so it's been awesome.
19. She was at Salem State.
Yeah.
She's really good family friends with my boyfriend too. It's tough.
Yeah.
But I worked with her, it's fine.
Yeah.
But I'll get the paper to you as soon as possible. Definitely by next week. I was going to bring it in today, but I've just been busy. I'll get you by Monday. Thank you. But I didn't want to miss another class. I'm like deathly sick to my ear
microphone.
But I emailed you about last week because that was the day we found out. Because it wasn't in class.
I'm never getting a message saying that.
But it wasn't going to be in class.
Oh, but, yeah, right. You didn't give a reason.
Oh, okay.
Or did you?
I think so because you told me if there's a sorry about my friend, if there's anything I need.
Because I would have responded to that message.
I told you I lost a friend and that we had just found out, so I couldn't be in class this Monday.
And he said,
yeah, he said, you gave my condolences.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, boy. Ah. Another one.
Yeah, I got back from the Springs and I forgot. When I was on campus. Sorry about that.
You got back from the Springs.
Oh, Colorado Springs.
Colorado Springs.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to flunk you just out of envy. How was it?
It was gorgeous.
Yeah.
It was really nice. Yeah. It was one day that was a blizzard, but the rest of it was like 65.
Wow.
Yeah, really nice weather.
Wow. So you're in the mountains and in hot springs?
We didn't go to the hot springs, but I was in, it's like
40 minutes outside of Denver.
Yeah.
It's like a very small city.
Yeah, Denver isn't such a beautiful city, is it?
Denver's not that pretty now, yeah. But Colorado Springs is really nice.
Yeah. Now, Boulder, I know, is a nice city.
I haven't been over to Boulder.
Yeah. I was only in Colorado once. My wife and I drove from Boston to San Francisco.
Okay.
And we went through Colorado. I remember being taken to a beautiful order.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay, so I'll have to get over my envy before. Everybody is so subdued, including me. I just got to sleep. Walker, you want to teach the rest of the class?
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
What would you like to talk about?
Well, perpetual peace, obviously.
Socialism.
Well, the socialist countries didn't do such a good job at perpetual peace. I remember a war between Vietnam and China. No, actually, I remember a war between Vietnam and Cambodia, and a near war between China and Russia. So what do you say about that?
All right, I have nothing to teach.
Oh, boy. So everybody has got to come to the opening of an exhibition of virtual art, the Art of Virtual Worlds, at the Harbor Gallery a week from Thursday. Okay, and the reason why you have to do that is that I've curated it. And there are about a dozen different high-tech methods of delivering this content. I'm going nuts with all of it. Because every high-tech procedure has a glitch. Have you noticed this? But there'll be screens, there'll be high-quality digital screens displaying artwork. There will be screens that have direct access to Second Life and also something that's called Reaction Grid, which are two different virtual worlds. And so artists will be showing their work inside that, and people will be able to interact with them through the screens. There are also other devices. There's an artist who has done an installation involving artificial bees. And he's created these artificially living bees that live in a... And the device that he built for people to interact with the bees is a beehive. And you pick up the beehive, the beehive sculpture, you pick it up and you blow into it. And as you blow into it, the behavior of the bees changes inside the virtual world. So they begin reproducing more rapidly or eating more food or whatnot, and you get to see the effects on the artificial ecosystem as this happens. But I really recommend that people go to it because there's some incredible stuff. There's stuff that you will not see in your daily routine in this show.
So yeah. You're going to do one here at UMass Boston?
That's where it is, the Harbor Gallery.
Oh, and there's the Harbor.
Oh, no, Harbor. No, I would not have anything
that's
to do with Harvard. Are you kidding? Those elitist bastards. Matter of fact, let's go across the river and beat the hell out of them right now.
To show them what
we'll show them when a working class can do.
Oh, me and my friends have renamed UMass Boston as the People's University.
The People's Republic?
The People's University.
Mm. Well, let's talk a little bit about the papers, okay? In general, I thought they were good. People tended to make the common mistakes that these beginning philosophy students generally make. And there are two ways to go wrong about writing a paper like this. One is to be content with listing beliefs, sort of tick them off. You know, this philosopher believed A, B, C, and D. And you go down a list of everything the philosopher believed. Epicurus believed that sensation ends at death, you know. But what makes a work philosophical is not the statement of beliefs. What makes a work philosophical is the arguments that are generated in support of beliefs. And for Epicurus, I know it's misleading because Epicurus writes manuals in which he does sort of tick off beliefs. But the backing for Epicurus's moral philosophy lies in his philosophy of nature. So you really need to delve into that in some detail. I'll talk about that a little bit in a second. The second thing that you need to do is grapple with the original writings. You know, you can't rely on secondary resources or on lecture notes wholly. The only way to do philosophy is to grapple with the words of the philosopher himself. And some people did that and some people didn't. Most people actually touched on Epicurus's writings, but very few, from this class anyway, very few discussions of the actual writings of the Stoics. You know, no references to Marcus Aurelius, or very few. Seneca, Epictetus, and of course they were all on the reading list. So yeah, that's something you need to do. Let me talk just a little bit about Epicurus's natural philosophy and the way it supports his moral philosophy. And remember, Epicurus makes two very controversial claims. One is that there's nothing to fear from the gods. And the other is that there's nothing to fear from death. And you see, the reason why you can't simply list those beliefs and say Epicurus believes that there's nothing to fear from the gods and there's nothing to fear from death is that they are controversial. And he's articulating these positions in a world where the majority opinion is exactly the opposite. Namely, that there is something to fear from the gods, and there is something to fear from dying, namely punishment at the hands of the gods. So just to assert the opposite, of course, is futile for Epicurus. No philosopher would anyway, but it's particularly futile to assert controversial positions without giving reasons for them. But he does give reasons for them, and the reasons lie, as I said, in his philosophy of nature. His philosophy of nature, remember, is a philosophy of the atomic structure of natural reality. And once again, when he establishes that conception of nature on the basis of rational argumentation, he doesn't just say that everything consists in atoms in the void. He has reasons for why no other conception can make sense of the natural world. And remember, the way he begins is by saying that the objects of our sense experience are composites. You know, there's no denying that. No one will deny that you can take an object that we encounter in the world of sense experience and break it apart. You know, even the human body can be broken apart. Everything that we encounter is a composite. And then he goes on to argue that composites could not exist unless ultimately the process of breaking things apart reached an indestructible, uncuttable part, which he calls the atom. Remember, Epicurus then goes on and says, we also have to explain not just the composite character of objects of nature, objects of sense experience, we also have to explain why it is, how it is, that they're caught up in processes of change. What does change involve? What is coming into existence and going out of existence? He tells us that since the atoms are uncuttable, they can never be broken up into parts. Therefore, they never come into or go out of existence. They are eternal. And the space that the atoms move in is eternal as well. If there hadn't always been space, then the atoms would have had no place to move into, in which case no events would have transpired. But we know that the natural world is a world of change. Therefore, rationally, he says, we have to conclude both that there are eternal atoms and an eternal void, an infinite empty space. Okay, given this understanding of nature, what does the process of coming into existence and going out of existence involve? Well, the process of coming into existence, since atoms can't come into existence, they're always here, what comes into existence is composites. And composites come into existence when atoms combine in certain ways, in certain definite ways. Atoms cannot go out of existence. So what does the process of going out of existence involve? It involves composites breaking apart into their component parts. So now we know what coming into existence and going out of existence means. Well, the going out of existence is, of course, relevant when we think about death. When we die, we know that the body decomposes. And when we say that the body is no longer present, we're not saying that the atoms that the body is composed of have disappeared. What we mean is that the combination of atoms that made up that particular body has decomposed. Is it possible that the soul could have a different fate? Well, Epicurus says, if there is nothing but atoms in the void, then the soul must consist of a particular combination of atoms as well. He has another argument, by the way, for the material character of the soul, in support of the material character of the soul. He says, if the soul did not consist in atoms, then how could it interact with a material body? How could an immaterial soul interact with a material body?
Is this in his letter to...
It's his letter on nature.
Is all this atom stuff?
Yeah. I mean, you've got to tease it out now. You know, I'm not saying that it's all on the surface, but it's there. So, he says, sensation would be inexplicable, motion would be inexplicable if the soul were not material. And in any event, we know that the only things that exist are atoms in the void. So the soul must be a composite physical substance just as the body is. If the body decomposes after life leaves the body, the soul, as a part of the physical organism, must also decompose. But if the soul decomposes, it ceases to exist as a soul, as the particular configuration that a soul is. The atoms survive, but what makes the soul capable of sense experience is the function, the role that it plays within the whole organism. As the organism disintegrates, both body and soul, sensation must come to an end. If sensation comes to an end, because sensation is a product of a living body, an ensouled body, and the soul and the body decompose at death, if sensation comes to an end at death, then there is nothing to fear from death. Because the only thing that we fear is pain. What we fear is painful experience. This is what fear of punishment is all about. Some kind of state of pain is going to be introduced into us. But if there is no soul after death, because the soul is an atomic composite, and that composite breaks down, then there is no sensation after death, and there is no pain after death. Therefore, it follows from a rational analysis of the natural world that there is no reason to fear death, that the fear of death is irrational. The fear of death is irrational. It also follows from a rational analysis of the natural world that the fear of the gods is irrational. And why? You know, what is it that we fear when we express fear of the gods? Well, we fear retribution. Well, first of all, we know now that there is no retribution possible after death because there's no sensation after death. So the only thing we could continue to be rationally fearing, he doesn't actually argue in this fashion, I'm sort of dotting the I's and crossing the T's here. The only thing that we could be continuing to fear is punishment in this life. Something bad is going to happen if we fail to sacrifice a bull to Apollo. If we fail to sacrifice a bull to Apollo, our crops are going to rot in the field. Apollo will make the sun stay in, and the crops will wither and die. Therefore, we must sacrifice the bull to Apollo. What Epicurus says is that this once again rests on an irrational conception of the natural world. If the natural world consists in atoms and the void, then the patterns of the weather, actually the patterns of whatever happens, have purely mechanical explanations. You know, the sun is hidden by clouds when particles of vapor come together in a certain fashion. There's no hand of the divine behind that. There are simply the processes of nature working themselves out. Well, just on, by virtue of an atomistic, you know, slash scientific understanding of the natural world, we can see that calamities are not the result of the malevolence of the gods. But, he says, if we understand what the gods are, we will also reject the idea that they visit punishments on us. Because what is it that we attribute to the gods first and foremost? It is a condition, according to Epicurus, of eternal bliss. The gods exist in an eternally blissful state. They are complete. They are completely fulfilled. There is nothing that they need. Well, a being that exists in a blissful state eternally is not interested in whether or not you sacrifice a bull to it. It doesn't need the goddamn bull. Right? It's not going to punish you if you fail to sacrifice the bull. It's not going to reward you if you do sacrifice the bull. Your fear that the gods will punish you is the result of a misunderstanding of the natural world and a misunderstanding of the nature of the gods. Once you become clear about those things, fear of the gods should vanish. You see, I think the reason why this line of argumentation is significant is that it's got a future ahead of it. The idea here is that suffering, mental suffering, physical suffering is a different matter, but mental suffering is the result of false beliefs. And in particular, false beliefs about the natural world. Once you understand how nature works, you divest yourself of those false beliefs and of the pain that they cause. By the way, you also can't really understand in depth anyway what pain and pleasure are unless you understand Epicurus' atomic theory. Because you remember, for Epicurus, the soul is a material object. It extends throughout the physical body. When we sense something, a certain vibration of soul atoms occurs. Pain is simply the violent and chaotic vibration of those atoms. And this is why the Stoic conception of ataraxia, of tranquility, is matched to this analysis, because what tranquility means is a calming down of the vibratory pattern of the soul atoms. Chill out, right? Chill, right? there's too much vibration going on. So take a breather, step back, let your soul atoms, settle down. In other words, what you want is a tranquil state of body and mind. A tranquil state of body and mind allows the human organism to function in its optimal condition. That's what pleasure is. That's what happiness is. See, it seems for a while like Epicurus is saying that pleasure is something negative, pleasure is the absence of pain. But he's not really saying that. What he means when he says that pleasure is the absence of pain is that pleasure is the absence of any impediment to the natural functioning of the human organism. The natural functioning of the human organism is a state of health. It's a state of well-being. It's the well-being of mind and body. If you want a concrete image of an optimal condition in which pleasure is fully experienced, think of yourself on vacation, in Colorado Springs, in the hot springs, or in the Caribbean. We're in the Mediterranean, and the water is warm, and you're floating in the water, and you feel this warm water, coming over your body, and you just forget everything about school, and you forget about work, you know, all the hassles that you experience day to day just vanish, and you become calm and relaxed. You know, for Epicurus, you've eliminated the obstacles that stand in the way of your natural feeling of well-being, which is what pleasure is, which is what happiness is. So pleasure for Epicurus is not, you know, the spikes of intense sensation, which he says generally you should avoid. Pleasure is that calm feeling of well-being that we have when all of the tensions are gone, both in the physical organism and in the soul. And that is directly a function of his conception of the way the soul works. So all I'm saying there is that when you write a philosophy essay, you've got to dig down into the details. And the other thing you have to do is actually consult the writers. Because obviously you're not going to find the details unless you do that process of consultation. Okay, folks? You all have the option of doing a rewrite on the midterm. I accept rewrites for midterm exams in my philosophy classes up until the last day of class. So don't say I never did a midterm for you. You know, I've often thought that this made sense because here I am, I spend a lot of time commenting on papers. And so let's say somebody doesn't do such a great job and I've spent a lot of time commenting on it. The commenting seems futile if they can't take the comments into consideration and come up with a better product, right? I mean, what the comments are is advice about how to improve the writing of the paper. So take the advice and rewrite the paper. And like I said, you have the option of doing that on the final day of class. The final, once it's done, it's done. But the midterm, you can rewrite.
When are you going to release the questions for the final?
Yeah, good question. I could release them next week, if you like, just so that you have something to, you know, to focus on, some orientation, point of orientation. But I'll tell you one right now, and it sort of emerges naturally from what we're studying in as far as Kant is concerned. You can write about Kant's proposal, his perpetual peace proposal. And in particular, I'd like you to address whether or not you think it's practical, whether it could work given our current social conditions. Now, we're also going to be reading, I have to revamp the website a bit. We're also going to be reading some works by a German philosopher, a contemporary German philosopher named Jürgen Habermas. And Habermas has taken up Kant's perpetual peace and tried to revamp it for the 21st century, I guess is probably the best way to put it. He sees certain problems with the UN structure. He's not opposed to the UN, but he sees certain problems which he thinks can be rectified. And so I'm going to have you read Habermas in addition to Kant. So a good paper would be a paper about whether or not you could conceive of the conquest of war, the ending of the practice of war, on the basis of Kant and Habermas's book. You might also want to write more specifically about Kant and the United Nations, and to what extent is the United Nations a fulfillment of the proposals that Kant makes in Perpetual Peace. If it's not, is it because those proposals could never have been implemented in the first place? Or is it for other reasons, so that the original document is really still a guide to vanquishing the possibilities of war? That kind of thing. So, as far as the current section of the course is concerned, you should be thinking along those lines. The last section of the course has to do with surveillance, and in particular, surveillance as understood through the eyes of Michel Foucault, who is one of the great social philosophers of the 20th century, French social philosophers. And you could imagine the kinds of things that I, you know, might ask about that. I might ask you to develop a, you know, Foucaultian analysis of what's happened in the U.S. post 9/11, for example. And there are plenty of sources out there. You know, that surveillance, people are often worried about kind of the Big Brother society, and there's no doubt that there's reason to worry about that. Every keystroke that you make on your computer when you're hooked up to the internet is recorded somewhere, you know, by your internet service provider. And it's accessible to state agencies should they want to go through the process of getting a court order. Sometimes they don't even need a court order to get into that kind of information. Privacy, you know, is more and more a thing of the past. But our situation isn't exactly that of a big brother state that is watching over everybody for a couple of reasons. One is that it's impossible to do so. It's impossible to make sense out of all of the data that's collected. I mean, imagine trying to make sense out of all of the computerized data on 300 million people. You know, I mean, that strains the capacity. What would that even mean? You know, how would you even go about doing it? You could begin by looking at various parameters, but the idea that you could actually follow the doings of 300 million people by having access to their computerized records is absurd. Now, and it's also true that we've got decentralized surveillance techniques now. Like for example, I've been filming you throughout this entire class, and that film is going directly to the internet, where I'm going to write funny things in bubbles coming out of your mouths. That's I'm obviously joking.
Cyberbullying.
What?
Cyberbullying.
But obviously, that happens all the time. You think about all the embarrassing videos that are on YouTube now. Think about the use of cell phones to record what the police are doing. And it's not just the case that the government is watching us. You know, we're now watching the government in ways that's very hard for them, you know, to get around. So, you know, there are issues about the surveillance society that need to be dealt with.
There was a video of a policeman that aired a while ago about picking up some kid who was skateboarding or something. Do you remember that one?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That made huge news.
Oh, sure. And of course, the classic case, and this was before the development of the cell phone, is the Rodney King case. And there it was a camcorder that photographed the police beating up Rodney King, and that had huge impact. But now, people can take films of anything using their cell phones, click a button, and it's uploaded to YouTube. You know, it's a different world. So trying to figure out exactly what surveillance means in our context is not so easy. But that's a topic for an interesting paper. So when you think about the final paper, you want to think in those two sort of very broad categories.
So is it going to be two separate questions that we have to answer both, or is it?
What I'm going to do is I'll probably give you about four or five questions, and you can do any mix of them you want. Some people freak out by doing they're told that I want them to do a 15-page philosophy paper. You know, they just don't know how they're going to generate 15 pages. So this option gives you the ability to write the final as a series of small essays, or a single long paper, or any combination of those. Okay. And then there's the other thing, which is that you can propose something, as long as it's sort of related to the course material. And if I think it's worth doing, okay, and you can go ahead and write your own topic. Okay. But at least that gives you some direction to be thinking in terms of the end of the class. It looks to me like you guys are ready for the end of the course. Is it May yet? Is it mid-May? Did I send it around? What's it called?
The attendance sheet.
Oh, you know what? I forgot to send one around. I'll send one around now. Okay. I'm going to make a few more comments about the perpetual peace, and then we'll call it a day, okay, because I'm exhausted. And you look like you're exhausted. Perpetual peace has two major divisions. The first division is what Kant calls preliminary articles of perpetual peace. And the second division is what Kant calls definitive articles of perpetual peace. The preliminary articles are the steps that Kant believes could have been taken in his own day to move in the direction of perpetual peace. Perpetual peace means an end to war. It doesn't mean simply the cessation of hostilities right now. It's not a truce. Kant is very clear about this. Perpetual peace is different from a truce, or even from a peace treaty. A truce or a peace treaty settles a dispute for a limited period of time in a limited part of the world. Perpetual peace is meant to put an end to war globally, essentially forever, right? Such a task, Kant says, is enormous. We're talking about a major change in the way people relate to one another globally. And therefore, because of the enormity of the task, this is not the job for a single generation. Kant thinks that it will require the work of many generations to arrive at perpetual peace. But the fact that it will require the work of many generations to arrive at perpetual peace is no excuse for not doing your part. You see, if each generation does not do what it can to advance in the direction of perpetual peace, then clearly we'll never achieve it. So even though no generation is going to be responsible for bringing the whole thing into existence, there is still an obligation to do what we can within our historical context. Last week I talked a little bit about why perpetual peace is possible in Kant's view, and we'll get back to that. But let's first look at the division between preliminary and definitive articles. The preliminary articles are the steps that Kant believed could have been taken by his own generation. Now, he doesn't expect them to bring about the full and definitive condition, but they are what can be done in his generation. So presumably every generation shy of the complete, you know, the completion of the project would be able to draw up its own preliminary articles, you know, of what's possible at this very moment. Now, we'll take a look at the preliminary articles in some detail next time, but they, just in general, they involve things like making genuine peace treaties, you know, peace treaties in which the causes of the dispute are addressed and settled so that the occasions for future wars between the nations involved vanish. Now, for example, the opposite of the Versailles Treaty, in which the treaty is signed at the point of a gun and there are still great resentments and humiliations harbored. Kant says that just prepares the ground for future war. What you need is a diplomatic practice that results in genuine treaties, peace treaties. And he says other things as well. He denies that nations have the right to interfere in the internal affairs of other countries. Now, this is interesting, and it's something we'll have to talk about, because it's a principle that the United Nations originally adopted, but has since distanced itself from. And the problem here, and it's a problem that Kant was really not in a position to address the way we are, the problem is what happens when a country engages in massive human rights violations. You know, is there an obligation, for example, not to intervene in Germany during the Final Solution? Or is there an obligation not to intervene in Kosovo during the war between the Muslims and the Serbs? Or is there an obligation not to intervene in Somalia or whatnot? See, the UN has tended to move away from the Kantian view that interference in the affairs of other countries is prohibited in the name of a justification for intervention in the name of the protection of human rights. And so we'll have to take a look at that. It's a big deviation, actually, from Kantian view. In the 18th century, Kant argues that there is never a good reason to intervene in the affairs of other countries, because when you do that, you substitute your own action for what ought to be the action of the domestic population. And you prevent the domestic population from rebelling against and rejecting its own tyrants, which is what its business ought to be. Obviously, your nation has an interest in preventing attack, and you have the right, so long as war is not abolished, to defend yourself from an aggressor. But you have no right to intervene in the affairs of another country, Kant says, in the supposed interest of their people. That is up to those people themselves. Yes?
Even if they're violent.
Well, that's the problem. That's a problem that Kant doesn't address in Perpetual Peace. And after all, remember, I mean, Kant dies 150 years before the Final Solution. Right? And we're coming at the end of, at the beginning of the 21st century, and we've lived through the end of a century that saw massive human rights violations. And they still, such human rights violations still exist. But that's really an artifact of our era and not of Kant's. Certainly there were tyrannical governments in Kant's day, but nothing like, you know, the rounding up of 6 million Jews and hauling them off to the concentration camps. You know, nothing like the ethnic cleansing. With one exception, and here Kant is really, I think, probably one of the most admirable figures in the history of philosophy. The exception is the treatment of Native Americans and of Africans by expanding European governments. And what you'll find in Perpetual Peace is one of the most ringing denunciations of Western imperialism and Western colonialism that you will read, you know, prior really to the writings of Karl Marx. And this is interesting because Kant is not a flaming radical. Kant is, you know, a very kind of moderate person in his political beliefs, but he is appalled at the destruction that Europe has unleashed in the Americas and in Africa and in Asia, and he condemns it without mincing words. It's a very interesting, we'll read the passage in class next time where he does this. But there were a number of such, you know, principles in the preliminary articles, right? Things that could have been accomplished, Kant believes, in his own day. The second group of articles, the definitive articles, are what they say. Those are the things that, should they be put in place fully, would themselves signify the end of war as an international practice. In other words, once we are able to implement the definitive articles, we have got perpetual peace. We've got perpetual peace. Now, what the definitive articles do, the first two of them, there's six preliminary articles and three definitive articles. The last of the definitive articles is very interesting, and it concerns immigration and the rights of the immigrant in the nation that he is residing in at the moment. And we'll take a look at that. But the first two preliminary articles indicate Kant's primary preconditions for the adoption of for the end of war as a human practice. And the first one, just briefly, is the spread of republican government throughout the world. Now, we'll have to talk about what that means. I mean, clearly Kant is not talking about, you know, the George Bush government. You know, for Kant, the republican government is the kind of government that is resulting from, that he sees resulting from the American Revolution and the French Revolution. The end of monarchy and the adoption of republican government, for him, is one major precondition for the end of war. And he predicts that it's going to happen, that republican government is going to spread, and he was absolutely right about that. And when Kant was alive, there were three, maybe four, republican governments in the world. There was France, there was the United States, there was Holland, and Switzerland, these portions of Switzerland. There were only four. Now almost every nation state claims to be a republic, right? And many genuinely are, in Kant's sense, a republic. So the first precondition is the expansion of republics, they're spread throughout the world. And the second precondition, and here's the key, right? Here's the key element in perpetual peace, is the development of an international federation of nation states under the rule of law. The purpose of the law is to adjudicate disputes between nations without resort to war. And we'll talk about next time exactly what that means, what the structure of that is, and why Kant is able to argue that it is a possible institution, and therefore why he's able to argue that we have a moral obligation to work to realize it. Okay? Perpetual Peace is a short work. Read it again. Read it a third time. Read it a fourth time. The secret to philosophy is rereading. Because on first reading, philosophers always seem to be talking nonsense. Or at best, gibberish. Right? You have to read them and reread them. Because after all, what they're claiming to do is think deeply. And normally we don't think deeply. You know? So the process of deep thinking requires some real effort. So since the document is so short, my suggestion is use this as an opportunity to read and reread. Don't neglect the appendices, which I've included in the document, because they're important. That's where Kant lays out his general argument that it's possible to achieve perpetual peace. And because it's possible, it's morally obligatory to do so. Okay, folks? All right. Go home and get a good night's sleep and like that. Hey, you have all these papers I got to grade. The work is never done.
Perpetual grading.
I know. Yeah, that's right. Perpetual grading.
That's what happens when you use students as means for a salary.